Palestinians have also condemned the international community's silence on Israeli crimes in the Negev. People here vow to stand by Palestinians in the Negev who have been subjected to ethnic cleansing by the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
After the Friday prayers, people gathered to protest against Saudi Arabia's ongoing war on Yemen, demanding Prime Minister Imran Khan to use his influence to stop the Saudi war on Yemen.
Yemenis' chants are down with USA, down with Israel, and down with Al Saud. They are the best Muslims who are fighting with Israel and other US allies, sacrificing their children and loved ones. Those killing Yemenis are arranging anti-Islamic concerts in the Holy Land in the name of modernity, and even banned recently an Islamic preaching groups from India and Pakistan.
Yemen is facing an unequal war for more than 7 years now. The war has claimed tens of thousands of lives, many of them women and children.
Recently, we are witness that the Yemeni people are more than Palestinian and Kashmiris are oppressed. So it is our duty as a Pakistani, I feel that it's our obligatory duty to stand with the oppressed people of Yemen and to condemn all of the oppressors, including United States, European governments and their puppets, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and other allies.
Rights groups say while countries continue to turn a blind eye, there will be no end in sight to this horrendous conflict that has seen immeasurable suffering inflicted upon the men, women and children of Yemen. Yemenis have been knocking on all doors demanding accountability and justice. Member states owe it to them to take this forward at pace. The welfare of millions is in their hands. Protesters are outraged at the ongoing Saudi atrocities in Yemen. They are calling on the international community to take immediate actions and end the bloodshed. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson coming out fighting this week. Not the contrite, apologetic Prime Minister a week earlier over Partygate, allegations of rule-breaking parties under his roof during lockdown last year.
Even though these things are quite damaging, none of them constitute an artillery shell into his bunker. So that's why Boris is still alive and peddling his pipe.
Boris Johnson's list of problems have grown bigger in recent weeks as more images and allegations of illegal parties at his residence emerged. The result, an official inquiry and a police investigation. The former by senior civil servant Sue Gray. The outcome of those investigations are yet to be published, but the scandal is taking its toll. Apart from the opposition, some members of the Prime Minister's own Conservative Party have called for his head. Others say they're waiting on the Sue Gray report.
Well, of course, we all want to know the story, warts and all, but the police are saying that it would prejudice a police investigation. And much as we don't like that, nobody's going to be able to stop them taking the line that they choose to take. What I fully expect is that the Sue Gray report will reveal more of the same sort of antics.
While some MPs in the Prime Minister's Conservative Party sit on the fence, the Court of Public Opinion has already come up with a verdict.
If he's found to be guilty of these things, then I guess he's got to go.
He should quit. Very hypocritical from start to finish.
Just admit it and just say it happened.
He should resign.
That has meant plunging popularity ratings, a 32-point lead for Labour, meaning some Conservative MPs would face a near wipeout if a general election were to be held now. Add to that a cost of living crisis and fresh accusations of corruption over the funding of his Downing Street flat refurbishment.
It's hardly the first time Boris Johnson is having to wriggle through controversies, but the odds are very different this time. If he's found to have misled Parliament about those parties, he will be in breach of the so-called ministerial code. Saeed Purizza, London.
North Korea Thursday conducted a round of ballistic missiles testing, firing two short-range rockets off its east coast. Analysts suggest North Korean leader Kim Jong-un wants to show his people he's their defender, although the tests have several purposes.
They're trying to make a point regarding the South Korean presidential election. They're trying, I think, to intimidate South Koreans into thinking, look, you've got to come to terms with us, the North Koreans.
Since late 2017, North Korea has not conducted a long-range missile test or a nuclear test in the hopes of making a deal with former U.S. President Donald Trump on sanctions relief. No deal has materialized, and leader Kim has recently indicated the moratorium on long-range missile testing and nuclear testing has expired.
He said that he might want to go beyond simply testing missiles, implying, not saying directly, but implying that he might want to test an intercontinental ballistic missile, an ICBM, that's capable of carrying a warhead to the United States. And he might even want to have another underground nuclear test.
The U.S. has criticized the recent testing, while China places the blame for tensions on the U.S. reliance on sanctions on North Korea.
South Koreans will head to the polls to elect a new president on March 9th. With North Korea conducting 6 rounds of missile tests in just the past month, security, military affairs, and relations between Seoul and Pyongyang are likely to figure heavily in that election. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Shias in Italy, The Path of Minor Islam in Diaspora is the title of a recent book which illustrates the role, practices and ethnic composition of the Shia communities of Italy. The author is the Iranian expat and Palermo-based Minu Mishahwalad, an established academic researcher with a vast portfolio of publications on Islamic law and Iran's history. Mishahwalad's work was carried out in the span of 3 years in 13 different Italian cities, mostly in the north of Italy, where the bulk of the Shia communities reside.
A large number of Shias have moved to Italy's wealthy north for work-related reasons. According to rough estimations, they make up about 5 to 10% of the 2.5 million Muslims residing in Italy. The majority of them are from Pakistan, Iran, Afghanistan, and Lebanon. And then we have the Italians who have converted to Shia Islam.
Immigrants from Pakistan and the Indian subcontinent are very active in social events and religious rituals, such as the large Ashura ceremony in front of the Milan Central Station. However, also political activism is widespread, particularly among Shias living in Rome, with events organized in solidarity with the assassinated top Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qassem Soleimani.
To our Shias generally organize more events and commemorations compared to Sunni Muslims residing in Italy. Another important aspect of my research shows how among the Shia faithfuls are today also a growing number of Italians. They have found in the Shia Islam a spiritual and political place where they can stand against the U.S. and Israelis' hegemony, where their traditional family values and love for artistic expression are welcomed.
About 2.5 million Muslims are living in Italy, making Islam the country's second largest religion. However, unlike Christianity and Judaism, Islam isn't formally recognized, meaning that mosques cannot receive public financing support, Islamic marriages have no legal force, and Muslim workers aren't entitled to take days off for religious festivities. Mishahwalad's research book also examines how Shia religious leaders in Italy interact with Shia religious authorities in a diasporic context. Max Civili, Rome.
It's what occupation looks like. U.S. troops wander around an independent country without any legal justification, invitation, or UN mandate. The U.S. officially intervened in Syria in 2014 under the pretext of fighting Daesh, something Syria dismisses as lies. The military prosecution in Syria held a press conference asserting it has collected evidence of U.S.-Daesh cooperation in Syria.
The military prosecution in Syria obtained material evidence that the U.S. has almost direct control over Daesh and its terrorist activities in Syria using its illegal base in Al-Tanf. We have proof that many Daesh terrorists are being trained by U.S. forces in that base. We monitor the terrorists moving freely there with their weapons and vehicles.
For years, the U.S. has been looting Syria's oil after occupying areas in the oil-rich north and northeastern territories. The military prosecution in Syria vowed to judicially pursue the U.S. for all its crimes.
The result of our investigations into the U.S. violations in Syria, which led to destruction and casualties, threat to our sovereignty, theft of oil and wheat, illegitimate sanctions and control over Daesh on territories of a U.N. member state, enables us in the near future to officially make accusations against the U.S. administration and its forces in Syria.
The military prosecution also accused the U.S. of promoting division by supporting a separatist ideology among the so-called SDF, providing them with weapons and ensuring they get all Syria's oil, let alone the U.S. airstrikes, which killed or displaced thousands of Syrians and destroyed its infrastructure.
It hasn't been a day or two, a month or a year. It's been almost 8 uninterrupted years of U.S. violations in Syria, at least since the intervention of the U.S.-led coalition. But regardless of how much time they're planning to stay, Syrian officials don't spare a chance to reiterate that their country will be liberated from terrorism and illegal foreign presence. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Protests against a highly divisive bill have intensified in London as debates rage inside Westminster. The Nationality and Borders Bill has several controversial clauses which minority groups have accused of being racist and turning black and brown Brits into second-class citizens.
The fight over this clause is far from over. It remains in the House of Lords, who are debating the various controversial clauses which remain as part of this wide bill. Now, there is a lot of division to various clauses, and if the Lords decide that they want amendments to it, it will bounce back to Parliament.
The bill seeks to provide the Home Office with additional powers to revoke citizens' nationality status and deny access to refugees fleeing to Britain. The government have offered reassurances, with Home Secretary Priti Patel claiming the law would be used only in exceptional circumstances on people who pose the most risk to the UK. But critics find it hard to trust Number 10.
Trust is something that needs to be earned. It's not a right for the government to assume that they're going to have trust from its citizens, especially when they're putting something in which is so vague that it leaves too many interpretations open.
Priti Patel is actually quite a disgrace to her ancestors. As a migrant, she knows that she came from the backs of those who were colonized by the system. And now you create a bill to oppress those. I think that's pretty fascist for me. And just because she's got a little bit of power, she's forgotten who she's made from, where she comes from. And just because she sits with some people with privilege, I'm using my privilege to use it to create a change for other people. What is she doing?
Having been passed by MPs in the House of Commons last December, the bill is now going through the House of Lords, where peers are suggesting amendments. The bill likely won't become law for the next few months, leaving plenty of time for further protests. Robert Carter, London.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has spent much of the past fortnight calling and meeting his MPs to persuade them to stick with him, as the row about lockdown-busting parties has grown. We now present you an article written jointly by Toby Helm and Mark Townsend. The piece is titled, UK Conservatives Charged with Levelling Up Stunt to Save Boris Johnson's Job. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Observer. The British government has been charged with trying to manipulate announcements on extra funding for poorer parts of the United Kingdom in a desperate attempt to save Boris Johnson's premiership. An extraordinary row blew up after Michael Gove's Department for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities released a press statement before publication of a Levelling Up white paper recently, saying 20 towns and cities would benefit from a new £1.5 billion brownfield fund. The release, which named only Sheffield and Wolverhampton as recipients, claimed that 20 areas will benefit from developments combining housing, leisure and business in sustainable, walkable, beautiful new neighbourhoods. Michael Gove added that the radical new regeneration programme would prove transformational and deliver on the government's flagship policy to create a more equal country. He claimed, "This huge investment in infrastructure and regeneration, which will spread opportunity more evenly and help to reverse the geographical inequalities which exist in the United Kingdom." But after the Observer contacted senior sources at the Treasury to ask if its ministers had signed off on the promised £1.5 billion, Michael Gove's department backtracked and confessed that the new fund was not new money at all, but would be made up of levelling up funds that had been announced by the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, in his spending review last autumn. The confusion was seized upon by Labour and other opposition parties as evidence of the lengths that Boris Johnson and his ministers are prepared to go in order to persuade Conservative MPs in so-called red wall seats to stick by the Prime Minister before the imminent publication of a report into the Partygate scandal in coming days by senior civil servant Sue Gray. If at least 54 Conservative MPs write to Sir Graham Brady saying they want Boris Johnson to go, it will trigger a vote of confidence in the Prime Minister. If he were to lose the vote of Conservative MPs, it would mark the end of his premiership. Shadow Leveling Up Secretary Lisa Nandy said the Tories had been caught out trying to spin that extra money had been found for poorer areas when the white paper actually contained nothing they did not already know about. Lisa Nandy said, "I don't think Tory MPs are going to find it very reassuring when the supposed new pot of gold contains not a penny of new money." The Scottish Nationalist Party leader in Westminster, Ian Blackford, added, "Not only is the government trying to take the public for fools, they're also trying to take their own MPs for fools. It shows the lengths they're prepared to keep Boris Johnson in power. It is beyond contempt." The Liberal Democrats' deputy leader, Daisy Cooper, said the episode showed the government was not remotely serious about levelling up this country. Boris Johnson has spent much of the past fortnight calling and meeting his MPs to persuade them to stick with him, as the row about lockdown-busting parties has grown. One former minister told The Observer recently he had been reassured by the Prime Minister personally that his area would receive help for local industries, which had persuaded him to stay loyal to the Prime Minister. In spite of the government's troubles, the latest opinion poll for The Observer shows Labour Party's lead over the Tories had shrunk to 5 percentage points, with Keir Starmer's party on 39%, down 2 percentage points compared with a fortnight ago, while the Conservatives are up 2 percentage points on 34%. But while the Labour bounce over Partygate appears to have peaked and gone into reverse, the party is now favoured by more voters to do a better job than the Tories on 10 out of 14 policy issues, including tackling crime and handling immigration. Both are subjects on which the Tories have traditionally been strong. On crime, Labour is now 3 percentage points ahead of the Conservatives, and on immigration, it is 4 percentage points ahead. On Saturday night, 29th of January, Sue Gray, who on Friday was asked by the Metropolitan Police to make minimal references in her report to serious matters to do with the gatherings that the Metropolitan Police is investigating, was understood to have still not yet submitted her report to No. 10 Downing Street. Sources indicated she would only do so on a day when Parliament is sitting, so Boris Johnson would be obliged to go straight to Parliament to make a statement, rather than giving him a weekend to spin his conclusions to the media. One White House source said he expected the report to make uncomfortable reading for all concerned. Another said Sue Gray is very clear how she wants this handled. She will hand it over on a day Parliament is sitting because she believes strongly in the propriety of the process. Meanwhile, there were calls on Saturday night for the Metropolitan Police to be discharged from its investigation because of a conflict of interest. The demands came from officials tasked with monitoring the force, who claim it cannot be trusted to deliver on such a politically sensitive case. Unmesh Desai, whose questioning at the London Assembly recently led to the Metropolitan Commissioner Cressida Dick announcing the investigation, said an outside police force needed to take over the inquiry. Desai, Labour's London Assembly policing and crime spokesperson, said he was writing to the Commissioner this week, raising his concerns that Cressida Dick's boss is in effect the Home Secretary Priti Patel, who in turn owes her position to Boris Johnson. Desai, a member of the Police and Crime Committee, which scrutinises policing in London, said, "It's a clear conflict of interest. Wouldn't it be better for the outside force to investigate?" Speaking on behalf of a number of committee members, Desai added, "You could even call in a retired chief constable to oversee it. The evidence is all there." Boris Johnson controversially backed Priti Patel after she was found to have bullied staff in an internal inquiry in 2020. The Home Secretary was recently thrown her full support behind the Prime Minister over the lockdown parties. Pretty Patel had prompted further controversy last year after handing Cressida Dick a two-year extension as Metropolitan Police Commissioner, despite a series of scandals that have embroiled the country's most senior police officer. The side will also urge the Commissioner to make sure Metropolitan officers are investigated for potential breaches of COVID regulations while deployed at Downing Street. He will ask the Commissioner to review the Met's Diplomatic Protection Group, which is tasked with monitoring premises such as number 10 Downing Street, amid concern they may have colluded by allowing the parties to take place. Moreover, according to a landmark new report, England's north-south divide continues to deepen despite 2 years of levelling up rhetoric from the government. Entitled State of the North 2021 and produced by the Institute for Public Policy Research North, the northern branch of the Institute for Public Policy Research think tank, the report compares levels of public investment in London and southeast of England with that in northern England. Its authors estimate that in 5 years to 2019-2020, London received the equivalent of £12,147 per person, while in the north of England that figure was only £8,125 per person. Treasury data indicated that if investment in the north had matched that in London over the 5 years from 2014-2015, it would have meant an extra £61 billion of spending in areas such as transport, infrastructure and skills. The report states that the south-east of England is home to one-third of the UK population, but now accounts for 45% of its economy and 42% of its wealth. The stark disparities will fuel concerns among Red Wall Conservative MPs that the government's flagship policy is underfunded and do not fulfil Boris Johnson's promise to supposedly rebalance the economy. The Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, has effectively capped the main levelling up fund at £4.8 billion for this Parliament. Critics say this is a drop in the ocean after decades of underinvestment and 10 years of austerity cuts. In November, after pressure from the UK Treasury, the promised eastern leg of HS2 from Birmingham to Leeds was scrapped and a proposed high-speed line between Manchester and Leeds downgraded. At the time of those decisions, the chair of the Northern Research Group of Tory MPs, Jake Berry, challenged Boris Johnson over whether voters in the North were right to take the Prime Minister at his word.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavita Hawaii. 750 Daesh terrorists relocated in Syria under U.S. air cover. For many, this might be shocking news, if it is reported at all in the first place. For those familiar with the U.S. and when it comes to Daesh terrorists, it doesn't come as a surprise, the U.S. support for Daesh terrorists. In this case, it was a result of a prison outbreak in Syria. But what will the U.S. use these Daesh terrorists for? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why this has attributed the attacks in Hasaka to Daesh and American occupation forces, stressing that members of the U.S.-led coalition have enrolled terrorists to spread chaos and destabilize Syria. Let's get more on this from our correspondent, Muhammad Ali, who joins us from Syria's capital, Damascus. So, Mama, tell us the latest on this, and there are sporadic reports that say this, I guess, the whole thing has not subsided or ended really yet. There's still skirmishes that are going on.
Yes, exactly. There are still some clashes reported, perhaps in the vicinity of the Ghouran prison, which Daesh sleeper cells attacked just about a week ago in order to free the other prisoners or detainees inside that prison. Now, what recently happened, according to Russian media, is that the United States forces in that governorate in Al-Hasakeh helped and transported 750 Daesh terrorists to get out from that area and then transported them to Al-Hasakeh. Perhaps, maybe according to analysts, this answers the question you just said about what is the purpose of getting those terrorists out. What is for the United States to get them out from that area to Deir ez-Zor? They moved them to Al-Bukamal, where analysts believe they moved them. They want them to attack Syrian the Syrian army and allied forces in that area, because it's the Syrian army that is in control of Deir ez-Zor's southern countryside, in Al-Bukamal in particular. According to the Russian reports, the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces also retreated from three positions around the prison, enabling those terrorists to get out, then gather in two locations in Al-Hasakeh to then be transported out with the help of U.S.-led coalition reconnaissance drones towards the Al-Bukamal and Deir ez-Zor's southern countryside, in addition to the surroundings of a mountain called Al-Bishri over there. This is definitely not a surprise. However, there are many question marks on why the United States keeps supporting Daesh terrorist groups, especially in light of other accusations and reports by Russia previously in the last year that the United States is actually training Daesh terrorists in the base it occupies, the illegal base of Al-Tanf on the borderline between Syria and Iraq.
Yeah, that's what we're going to expand on with our guests, but thank you so much for mentioning that. We appreciate it. Muhammad Ali from Damascus. Well, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the debate, of the spotlight, I'm sorry. We have Laith Mouhouf, who's an activist and political commentator, joining us from Beirut. Also joining us is Tony Gosling, who's an investigative journalist, joining us from Bristol.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome to you both. And Laith Mouhouf, maybe you can tell us exactly what has happened, because it might be, to an outsider, very confusing what this incident is all about, what actually went down. So why don't you tell us what you have seen and heard and read about this particular incident?
Well, definitely the situation is that the United States is not able to achieve the same goals with its SDF, what is called the Syrian Democratic Forces, or the Kurdish Contras that it works with, which mainly is to attack the Syrian military and to expel it from the territory on the border with Iraq. We have seen that these chameleon Contras, both the Kurdish Contras and Wahhabi Contras, exchange positions whenever the United States need them to do. That's why I personally call them chameleon Contras. And in this situation, as your reporter from Syria mentioned, they are clearly indicating that they want to push back the Syrian military from Al-Bukamal post, which is the most important post between the Iraq and Syria that is still under the Syrian government's control, and where the continued activities between Iraq and Syria and the axis of resistance maintain that position. So we're right now at a juncture in the situation where the Kurdish Contras have reached their limit of what they can do, and the Americans are back to their primary Contra that they've used, which is Daesh, the Wahhabi Contras. Sorry about that.
That's okay. Tony Gosling, over to you. The way that this news is reported, do you have us, Tony Gosling?
Yeah.
Okay. The way that we have this news reported is the fact that you have 750 Daesh terrorists that have relocated or were relocated in Syria under U.S. air cover. And SUVs were used, Jeeps were used, and you have some of the most dangerous Daesh terrorists from this prison under U.S. air cover. This is bringing back the notion, if it ever really went away, and I'd like to find out from you, the U.S. support for terrorists. This is a general question. What do you make of what you have heard?
Well, I mean, it seems quite obvious that as the stranglehold on the Western press, represented by the massive, the incarceration of Julian Assange and others, the idea that anybody that tells the public what's going on is going to be treated like, scapegoated Assange. This is providing increasing cover for the United States, particularly other countries too, to just get on and do whatever they want without even bothering to try and hide it. So, the idea that, they're getting intelligence help in the past, which has been covert, now it seems that there's no attempt really to hide the strategic support which these maniacs have been getting from the United States, and this is arms, etc. So they have the only thing that really surprises me here is that this isn't really being reported at all in the West anymore. The Western public that's paying for this doesn't understand and doesn't know where their taxpayers' money is going. This whole idea that ISIS, is some sort of rogue unit, I think should be blown out of the water by this particular story, if anyone gets to hear about it, which they do in most parts of the world, but not here in the West. And that is that right from the 1980s, the United States particularly, but MI6 and Britain as well, have been encouraging basically a mercenary Islamist force, they call it. Well, this is in a way of just trying to smear the whole religion of Islam. From Afghanistan, with the film Charlie Wilson's War, which if anyone's not seen, it's well worth watching. You can see what happened is basically a private forces working through one senator in the United States were encouraging this whole idea of setting up a mercenary supposedly Muslim army to fight the Russians. And this has carried on and on through Al-Qaeda, and now we're seeing it happening right now. Look, the reason that they're in Syria is very, very clear. They're trying to roll back the successes of Assad and Russia, and they're not giving up. And what they're doing is they're using, I think it's the most disgusting thing to do, is taking the Kurdish aspirations to statehood, which, if anyone remembers, were being talked about right the way back in 1990 in the first Gulf War. Oh, we must help the Kurds to get their own country, mm-hmm. And they're using this excuse in order to just basically use the Kurds and fund them to do the same sort of thing. So what we're looking at here is just another excuse to try and destabilize and overthrow Syria, which is part of General Wesley Clark's 7 countries in 5 years. He blew the whistle on this plan, which is to try and overthrow these countries, which the Americans seem to think that they can carry on continuing to do with no scrutiny whatsoever by the Western press.
Well, you mentioned the MI6, and I'm going to also put the CIA in that statement or in that phrase that you used, and throw this at you, Leif Maruf. In terms of these Daesh terrorists, it is not, maybe it's a good time to do this history check, where you have, in particular, this prison break had, not a prison break really, but some want to call it that, you had Swedish and Dutch ethnicities that were involved. And it's hard not to take into account the a famous case of the UK Swedish national Berlin Gildo, I don't know if you recall, was back in 2015, where there was a prosecution that took place, but that whole thing fell apart against him because British intel sources, along with CIA, came out that they were supporting the same Syrian so-called opposition groups as he was, and then in turn, the secret operation of providing them with weapons, intel, money, financial support, etc., was coming out to the fore. So this is not something new. To what extent do you think that is going on today? I could name other examples, though, maybe, which I'm going to address Tony Gosling there. But to what extent do you think this is going on today?
Well, look, our audience needs to understand there is really no such thing as ISIS, Daesh, or even the SDF, or the Kurdish Contras. They are all just mercenary armies that change colors depending on what their paymasters, tell them to do. Maybe the lonely fighter on the ground thinks that they are truly fighting in the name of Islam, or in the situation of the Kurdish Contras, that they are fighting for Kurdish liberation, but their commanders and their movers are intelligence assets, and this is all done very now openly. It's an old trick. The Saud family and the Wahhabi cult have been in the service of the British and now American imperialism since day one, since the 1930s. We don't even need to go further back than Afghanistan, since the 1930s and the occupation of Mecca and Medina and the desecration of the holy sites there, destruction of the graves of Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad's wives and brothers, and so this is a continuation of the same thing. And we have to understand that these are chameleon Contras that change color depending on what they're told to do. In the situation of what we see right now in Syria, they are being asked to direct their activities towards the border between Iraq and Syria to cut the supply line between the axis of resistance that spans between Tehran and Damascus through Abu Kamal. And we will continue to see this happening until the Americans are totally expelled from Syria, and hopefully that will be soon.
Well, looking for reasons that are coming out from Syria in terms of what has happened, there was an interesting statement made, Tony Gosling, and this was Syria's military public prosecution representative, in which he said there is an illegal U.S. military base in the Al-Tanf area near the border with Syria, Jordan, and Iraq. He said there is solid evidence, and this is something that the Russians have said time and again, along with the Syrian government. He said there is solid evidence that many members of extremist groups receive training from U.S. military personnel at this military base. And at the same time, members of extremist groups were given access to the base with free movement. We've heard this before, and this is coming out again, coming from this particular Syrian representative. Do you agree? Do you think there's military training going on there? And at this point, combine that with what has happened, this 750 Daesh terrorists, some very dangerous, and I guess an expertise at being a terrorist. Are they looking to make an advancement of any significance?
Well, of course, they're harassing and haranguing the Syrian government, the duly elected Syrian government. Look, I think we have to understand what's going on here. I'm not down on the ground. I can't tell if there's training going on there now or not, but I would not be at all surprised if it was. Look, you have to look at what is going on in the Middle East. The bigger picture is that these border areas are deliberately being made as blurred as possible by the tactics of the United States over there, and the British, of course. The idea is to break up these countries, effectively. You have to go right the way back to 1982 and the Israeli Oded Yinon plan, which spells this out. And after that, actually, there were two big reports done by the US military, part of their planning for the Middle East. This is how arrogant they are. They're basically just carving the Middle East up, a bit like the British did back in the First World War, with the Sykes-Picot plan. And they're saying in 2005, the American general, Thomas Barnett, had this blueprint for action, which was countries that need to be destabilized, and there were quite a lot in the Middle East he decided that the Americans were going to destabilize, followed in 2006 by Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters' plan called the New Middle East. This is a plan to balkanize the Middle East. To break countries up, the idea to blur the borders, and so what they want to do is to try and make, wherever there's a hard border somewhere, they want to break it up to make sure that people can pass backwards and forwards. And of course, those people generally have been refugees, and of course their own fighters. And you know, when looking at Syria, we have to just take a rain check on the casualties. Half a million dead, at least half a million dead in Syria, of which at least half have been civilians. This has been the product of this NATO-US-led plan. And actually, let's be quite clear, in cooperation with the Israelis, to balkanize the region so that Israel can start to expand. Mm-hmm. And also, if you go back to the beginning of the Libya so-called civil war, which was constructed by MI6 and the rest of them, there were immediately prison breaks. So what they did is they broke into prisons using special forces, and then the prisoners, as they were escaping, these are all, of course, violent criminals, most of them, but very dangerous people who should be in prison. They then destroyed all the records of the prosecuting services and the prison itself, burnt them all, whatever, destroyed them,
right.
And then they handed guns to those prisoners. So uh-huh. This is exactly the same thing going on in Syria today as we saw that helped spark the overthrow of Colonel Gaddafi. And what a disaster that's been in, sure. in Libya, with basically the country now being controlled by warlords.
What makes them think that this is going to help now, when you have it? You had at the height of the Syrian war, roughly in the years 2015-16, you had 1,000 armed, what they called opposition groups. We know they were terrorists. You had an estimated 100,000 of these terrorists, mainly made up of 27 factions. I can mention the groups Jabhat al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham. Of course, you had so many countries involved. Saudi Arabia, maybe they're involved at this point still. Qatar, Turkey, which we know Turkey is involved. Also the UAE, not to mention obviously the US, the UK, and the French. But they were not able to defeat the Assad government. Of course, you had Iran in its advisory role, you had Russia there, and you had, of course, the courage of the Syrian soldiers. So what makes them think that this can still happen?
Well, clear that
this Tony Gosling. Go ahead, Leif.
Yes, they know definitely that this is not going to make a big change on the ground. But what they're hoping for is a war of attrition. Right now, they want the Syrian government and the Syrian people, who are finally being, putting the country together and moving on, being able to live a normal life. They don't want none of that to happen while the Americans are, trying to open other war fronts in Ukraine and in Taiwan. So this is just a war of attrition and a harassment. It's not going to make a big difference on the ground, but it will definitely lead to more ethnic cleansing of the Arab and Assyrian population of the northeast of Syria. And, partially this is why they, did this in Hasaka city. This is a city that, was spared most of the fighting over the last 10 years in the country. And, as we know, the plan that the Americans have had is to change the demographic of northeast Syria and bring in all these Kurdish Iraqis and Kurdish Turks to settle the land and expel the indigenous population that is Arab and Assyrian. And so this is a continuation of that on a smaller scale, not to allow the Syrian people to have any rest moment. But will it change anything on the ground? Definitely not. And those who are planning this, the military and the intelligence assets of the United States, know that this is not going to change much of the reality on the ground, but it's just going to waste more lives and waste more resources for the country.
Tony Gosling, we can't go without mentioning how the U.S. has said time and again, and you mentioned Israel also, that they are on the same page in one respect when it comes to what's happening in Syria, in particular, and in Iraq also, and that is that they don't want what they call this Iranian influence. I'm not too sure what they really mean by Iranian influence. I mean, what, that we're not supposed to have regard for our neighbors? But I think one of their nightmares is coming true, and that is you have, with this 13th administration, a very pro, let's establish and enhance our ties with our neighbors, from Turkey, Iraq, obviously, Syria also there, along with other neighbors. So much so that we're also looking at the UAE to have visited Syria recently. Can't forget when you had the foreign minister, hug Bashar al-Assad. And you also have Saudi Arabia in a rapprochement type mode with Syria. The U.S. blasted the UAE for the foreign minister in particular for going to Syria and doing that. Is that something that is going against U.S. plans and may change the dynamics?
Well, look, let's use an analogy which is a bit more down to earth. So if the mafia brings somebody into a house next door to me, I'm not going to want that person to come into my living room and share a cup of tea. Whereas another one of my neighbours, I might wish to invite them in. This is really at the behest of President Assad. As to whatever he wants to do, he can invite in his friends and he can politely tell his neighbours, please do not come past my front door. And that is exactly the way that the UN Charter says things should happen. So there's no problem whatsoever. If Assad wants somebody in his country, he can have them. If he doesn't want to, it's his country. And let's make it absolutely clear, there's one word that explains why President Assad is still in Damascus, and that is Putin, that is Russia. And without the Russian help and support, the same sort of support as the Americans have been giving, in intelligence-wise anyway, he would not be there. The Russians need to maintain their base in the Mediterranean. And, of course, they also want to uphold the UN Charter. So that's why. So we've also got, by the way, this is not just the Western forces, using Islamist terror groups that they control and create, to create havoc around the world. They're also doing it within their own countries. We've just had the admission from the Spanish intelligence officer in court in Spain that in 2017 they blew up a bomb with the intention of blaming it on the Islamic groups, and the intelligence service of Spain was killing people inside Spain in order to destabilize Catalan referendum.
Thank you for that. I'm going to have to jump in and give Leith Maruf 30 seconds. I'm sorry, Tony Gosling. We just got 30 seconds quickly. Leith Maruf, are we looking at this particular prison break where 750 of these Daesh terrorists have been now escaped and supposedly taken to Deir al-Zor for there to be a forthcoming surge of any kind against Assad and his forces?
Yeah, I mean, like, look, it's 750, you know, terrorists is a very small number. They could create some havoc on the border in the Bukamal, but they will be crushed very fast. And this will be one of the last remnants of this activities in the land. You know, we have to see what will happen next with these Kurdish Contras that are playing the game with them also.
Thank you. I'm sorry about that. But thank you. Leith Maruf, activist and political commentator from Beirut. Tony Gosling, thank you so much. Investigative journalist there from Bristol. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From me, Kavita, we and the entire team, just goodbye.